Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. 2017 was the most expensive year for natural disasters in U.S. history, costing a total of $306 billion. That's billion with a B. That is according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. From California to Puerto Rico, intense fires, floods, and storms devastated large sections of the country. California's fires caused more than $10 billion in damages, making them the most expensive wildfires in U.S. history. In his recent cover story for Sierra, the magazine of the Sierra Club, today's guest, Jason Mark, writes, quote, "The mounting price tag of extreme weather events and the prospect of greater destruction to come has brought into focus a question that has been lurking at the edges of climate change conversations. Who should pay the costs of the death and destruction caused by human-driven global warming?" End quote. Jason Mark is editor of Sierra, the magazine of the Sierra Club, and he's author of Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And Jason wrote the cover story for Sierra called The Case for Climate Reparations. It's time the carbon barons paid for our unnatural disasters. And you can find it at yourcallradio.org. And Jason joins me in studio. Hi, Jason. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
It's great to have you. I really, really enjoyed this piece. A couple facts. Facts stood out for me. One, in December, the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society issued a first ever report linking extreme weather events to climate change. How significant is this?
Well, that was pretty significant because there's been this interesting, some listeners might have picked up on this, this interesting division between climatologists, right, who study and measure the entire world's atmosphere and climate and how that works, and meteorologists, right, which are the weathermen and women who are on the TV news or on the radio news telling us the forecast for the next couple of days. And for a long time, a lot of meteorologists kind of resisted some of the findings from climatologists. They say, we can't predict the weather a week out. How can you possibly predict what the weather's going to do on the entire planet 50 years from now? And so finally, meteorologists kind of have internalized that research and findings from the climatologists from the research models and have said, listen, at this point, it's obvious that human activities are impacting the global climate system and then the local and regional weather systems. The evidence is just too hard to ignore at this point.
Because I noticed that when there are fires or floods or hurricanes, even we are careful in connecting it to climate change. We want to make sure that we have all of the right scientific information.
Sure. And I think that judiciousness is important. I think it was especially important, say, let's call it 10 plus years ago, right, during, say, a Hurricane Katrina, where you had, you know, longtime environmental reporters were still kind of careful in how they connected that storm with human emissions and human activities. But now, a dozen years later, or close to a decade after, say, a Superstorm Sandy, right, which happened in 2012, so not a decade, but approaching a decade, the evidence is hard to miss, and increasingly we are seeing the human fingerprints on our global weather systems. And if you look at the fact that, you know, in the last, I mean, like 40 years, we've not had a below average month of global temperatures, it's increasingly easy to pick out the signal from the noise.
Mm-hmm. Here's another fact that stood out in your piece. The year 1988 provides an important baseline. More than half of all industrial CO2 emissions have occurred since then, since just 1988.
In the last 40 years. I mean, this is what some people, some earth scientists refer to as the great acceleration, right? As human societies have become more complex, as industrialization is kind of swept over the entire globe, all of these processes, including even evolution, right, is moving faster because of the way in which human civilization is putting a hand on the scale. And so, yes, I mean, burning coal in the 19th century, burning oil in the early 20th century, yes, those began the first human impacts on our global atmosphere via the greenhouse effect. But really, a lot of this has happened in the last 40 years as we've seen industrialization take off in new and huge economies, right, like China and India. That doesn't in any way, I think, remove the historical responsibilities that the U.S. remains the largest historical emitter, right, even though China has since overtook us in real time. But yes, the historical emitters, the U.S., Great Britain, Germany, have played an outsized role throughout history. But a lot of it has happened in the last 40 years.
So a lot of it is due to industrialization. What about population growth?
Oh, sure. I mean, more people burning more fuel, using more goods, eating more, right? I mean, one of the largest drivers of climate change is just deforestation connected to agriculture, mostly connected to raising livestock. So yes, more people on the planet, each additional person we have has an extra footprint. Mm.
Let's talk about some of these numbers, which in some ways it's hard to wrap your head around this. California's fires caused more than $10 billion in damages, making them the most expensive wildfires in history. Last summer, widespread flooding during Hurricane Harvey caused $125 billion in damages just in the greater Houston area. Hurricane Irma damaged $50 billion worth of property in Florida. Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico caused another $90 billion in damages. How do people come up with these numbers?
A lot of those are insurance claims. They're actually looking at what homeowners primarily, or business owners, I guess, are submitting to their insurance companies. So that's actually that number. And I should just clarify, that number about the California fires, that's just the Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino fires.
Wow.
The Santa Barbara fires that happened around Christmas time. And right, it's important to remember how surreal that was. I mean, literally, you know, I saw one video of a Cal Fire bulldozer driver listening to Christmas tunes as he's trying to create a fire break. So fires in a totally unprecedented season, what should be the rainy season here in California. Those Santa Barbara fires added another couple of billion dollars. And what happened in Houston, I mean, it was just the scale of that flooding, right, that covered huge sections of the greater Houston area. All of those homes damaged, you know, on, you know, certainly the first floor of the building. And that adds up. I mean, part of this is that we've just built more stuff. And so we've got more stuff and more expensive stuff in the way of these natural, but what I would actually say now are unnatural processes.
40 people lost their lives in the California fires. When you talk to people about how climate change has led to this kind of destruction, where do you begin?
I think you have to begin with real human stories so that it's clear that, again, you're right, Rose, it's really hard to wrap your mind around $93 billion or $100+ billion in damages. And so what I try to do in the case for climate reparations is I've threaded three real human stories into the larger, what essentially is an essay making the case for why the major carbon polluters should be held responsible for this crisis. So I share the story of a family from Santa Rosa who watched their home burn down. Again, not a family living out in the hills, right? A family right there in suburban Santa Rosa, a short distance from the 101 freeway. I share the story of a working class mother from Puerto Rico who lost her home, ended up in a FEMA shelter for more than 2 months simply because of, you know, kind of a clerical error. And she had this really moving story talking about how it felt like she'd been knocked down kind of three pegs on the ladder of life, right? I mean, her life was really set back by this storm for reasons that had little or nothing to do with her. And then the final story I tell is, you know, it's really very heartbreaking. It's about a family in Houston who lost six members of their family in those floods when an uncle tried unsuccessfully to evacuate this family's grandparents and four of the four of their grandchildren. And listen, the fact is real. I mean, people are dying in climate change related disasters. You know, we saw earlier this spring, I think it was in early May, off the chart heat records from Pakistan and scores of people dying from heat stress there. The heat waves that hit Europe and hit Russia in the early to mid aughts, I mean, those led to what, you know, the conservative estimates are tens of thousands of deaths. There's no question that human-driven climate change is going to lead to vast destruction and the loss of human lives.
All three of the stories you tell in your piece are horrific, but the one in Houston is especially horrific because, as you mentioned, a number of family members of the Saldivar family actually drowned. And what's amazing about this story and the story in California is that it happened so fast, right? And in the story in California, the family smelled something, and over the course of just a few hours, they realized they needed to get out quickly. And in the case of the family in Houston, they were in the van, and they were at one point laughing because the water was getting them wet, and this is just a regular human reaction, right? And then, boom, it happened so quickly, and they lost control of it, of the van.
Yes, they lost control, and I think that's kind of, in a way, sort of the leitmotif I was trying to tease out with these stories. I mean, I found these stories just through Gumtree reporting. I mean, I interviewed, I think, almost a dozen families in Napa, Sonoma, and then ended up focusing in on the Sherwoods. I went to Puerto Rico last November and did another dozen interviews there and kind of picked out this woman, Yesenia Cruz, Yesenia Ramos, because her story was so evocative. But I think what comes through, especially as you point out in that the Sonoma story and the Houston story, is how quickly these disasters come upon us. In a way, it's kind of a metaphor for, in general, the larger disaster of global human-driven climate change that's moving more quickly than I think we are prepared for. And by we, I mean both ordinary citizens and scientists, and certainly our government leaders, who are unprepared, I think, for the scale and the scope of the dislocations to come. So I was trying to sort of nod to the reader a little bit. The speed with which these individual disasters hit these families are emblematic of the speed with which the entire crisis is bearing down upon us.
And then you ask a very important question here. Who should pay the costs of the death and the destruction caused by human-driven global warming? You mentioned climate change reparations earlier, and we're starting to hear that more. You write that this is the shorthand for this claim, reparations meaning basically a rectification of past and ongoing harms. A plainer word would basically be justice. But as you point out, justice is elusive, it's difficult to calculate, and impossible to enforce.
So climate change reparations normally is talked about in a sort of a global context, right, between essentially the poorer countries of what we'd call the global south, right, and the industrialized countries of the global north. And it's been radioactive, as you can imagine, within global climate change talks, right? The wealthier nations and the historical emitters like the U.S. and the EU, they don't really want to acknowledge that they may have a debt that they owe to these poor countries, which have done very little to fuel climate change and yet are almost certainly going to experience the impacts first and worst. There is now some language in the UN, you know, framework on climate change that does recognize some responsibilities around what's called loss and damage, but it's still been the kind of, you know, the third rail of global climate talks. What I talk about in this article is less what's happening in the international context and more what's happening right here just domestically within the U.S., and that is now this really novel and unprecedented effort by what is now 13 cities and counties across the U.S., to say to the major carbon polluters, and that's basically big oil and big coal, but primarily big oil, the major oil companies, to say you have a responsibility to help cover and shoulder some of these costs.
Today, we are speaking with Jason Mark, editor of Sierra, the magazine of the Sierra Club, and he wrote their latest cover piece called The Case for Climate Reparations. It's time the carbon barons paid for our unnatural disasters. Jason is author of Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so I'm sorry, but we cannot take any of your phone calls. Before we talk about the carbon barons, which you call them, and the lawsuits against them, I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about what responsibility wealthy nations have. And in your piece, you write that in 2007, the Bali Action Plan suggested that wealthy nations take steps to assist vulnerable countries. The action plan established the idea, at least in theory, that the rich countries that have built their wealth by burning fossil fuels should help the poorer nations that are suffering the harms from a distorted atmosphere. So that's 2007. That was 11 years ago. What has really happened since then?
I mean, there was some money that was set up through the Paris Agreement, right, which is essentially now the binding international agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And there are mechanisms in there for climate change adaptation as well as mitigation and technology transfers. Now, a lot of the wealthy countries haven't fulfilled all of their pledges. You know, the usual suspects, mostly Scandinavian countries, have put money into that fund. The U.S. certainly has not fulfilled its obligations. So there are mechanisms now, and there is, you know, a global adaptation fund. I don't know that the money that's in there is going to be sufficient for the scale of what some countries are going to have to, you know, the burden they're going to have to bear. But yes, there is at least, again, something of a recognition that there are these other responsibilities.
So you said that the U.S. has not stepped up. We know that nothing's going to happen under this administration.
Correct.
What happened under the Obama administration?
The Obama administration did make pledges to put money into this Green Adaptation Fund. But I have to say, and I probably should have boned up on this before I came on the show, I'm not certain that all of those pledges were actually made. It is hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it's real money,
right?
That will be, you know, transferred from the wealthier industrialized countries to poorer nations. But whether it's going to be on the scope of what's required, I think is doubtful.
The question surrounding the Maldives has gotten international attention. The inhabitants of the Maldives, made up of more than 1,200 islands, most of which are no more than 1 meter above sea level, are already feeling the effects of climate change. But they obviously didn't cause this crisis. So how should a country like the Maldives be compensated?
I mean, that's the great inequity of global climate change, is these poor nations, the Bangladeshes and the Bolivias, the Marshall Islands, Kiribati, or the Maldives. Yes, they have done very little simply because they have smaller populations and because they're relatively poor. They've done very little to fuel global climate change, and yet they are already experiencing the impacts. What needs to be done, again, I think, is a real transfer of money to help those countries cope. I think it's likely that some of those countries, and their leadership knows this, may be in the unfortunate position of having to essentially undertake what would be called a managed retreat, right? Mm-hmm. Some people are going to have to leave. We're already seeing that in the Marshall Islands. You've already seen Marshallese coming here to the U.S. essentially as climate refugees.
Wow. You ask so many important questions in your piece. Here are a few more related to the Maldives and how rich countries should pay. How can any individual, any set of people, or even any nation be held accountable for so vast a problem? Is it really fair, for example, to ask a poor family in New Orleans to compensate a rich family in Bangladesh for the harm done by rising sea levels?
That's the other thing that makes this, the reparations or climate reparations in an international context, makes it so very hard, is to disentangle or disaggregate the fact that just as it's true that a poor Marshallese has done very little to fuel climate change, it's also true that a relatively poor American has done very little compared to a relatively wealthy American to fuel climate change. And so sometimes talking about this at the nation state level can obscure more than it reveals, right? It makes it very hard to kind of trace back accountability and responsibility, which I do think is one of the reasons why there's some cautious optimism among climate change advocates and some folks in the legal community about these lawsuits, right? It doesn't put the burden equally on all 310 million Americans. It's saying there are some among us 310 million Americans who are uniquely culpable.
Hmm. What did you hear from the people you interviewed about these ethical dilemmas?
So I was really careful as a reporter. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't sort of using these families, right, as kind of a prop to tell this larger story. And so I was really careful about explaining to them my intentions, that I was doing a larger story about climate change responsibility and climate change reparations. And at the end of every interview, I asked them, who do you think should pay? And no, none of them said, I think the major oil and gas companies should pay. Two out of the three families that I profiled were people, I think it's fair to say, of a deep Christian faith, and they thought these were acts of God, right? Mm-hmm. The family from Sonoma, were, like many Sonoma residents, kind of pointing the finger at PG&E, saying, well, maybe PG&E is responsible because they didn't manage their power lines correctly. And I think those answers and sort of they reveal the difficulty of us, again, wrapping our minds around not only the problem, the scale and the scope of global climate change, but trying to figure out who is responsible. It's not a self-evident answer. I think we'll get to this later in the show, but it is in fact hard to think about who exactly should be held responsible for all of this death and destruction.
And class and race plays such a huge role in all of this, because some of the people in Northern California who had money and family members, maybe a relative had an extra house, I've heard of these stories. Obviously, losing your home is horrific, but they had a place to go. Whereas people who lived in a mobile home park, a lot of these people are still living in a homeless shelter, and they have nowhere to go.
Correct. Yes. I mean, that's, again, is the other inequity. Again, even in a country like the U.S., obviously, in general, a wealthy country with a lot of resources, because our social safety net is essentially in tatters, those people who have got less resources are going to, again, suffer first and worst.
And Hurricane Katrina hit us all in the face with that issue.
And Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. I mean, it is the blind spot in this society around what is, I think it's fair to say, mainland society, or folks who don't have connections to the Puerto Rican community, the Puerto Rican diaspora. It's easy to forget in some ways that Puerto Rico is part of this country, that those are U.S. citizens, granted in something of a quasi-colony. And they've been totally neglected. In late May, we saw this reporting from the Washington Post showing that the actual death toll of deaths associated with the hurricane and then the long-running blackout are more than 4,000.
Yeah.
So the official death toll is still 64. I think the official death toll from the Commonwealth government there in Puerto Rico says 64. But if you look at all the associated deaths, Washington Post is now reporting more than 4,000, which would make it a more deadly natural disaster than Hurricane Katrina.
Mm. What struck you the most when you went to Puerto Rico?
I have to say, and this is kind of less connected to the hurricane than really to the response, was the quite impressive grassroots response. All of the work that was done block by block and community by community to clean up and repair in the weeks immediately following the disaster. Of course, that community response, as inspiring as it is and was, then runs up against the limits of what you can do, right? Like, no community can restore a power grid. No one's, right? No, Jane and Joe Puerto Rico do not have the skills, right? No one's got, I mean, that's the infrastructure of a scale that's beyond any neighborhood or block, emergency response. But I would say, yes, I mean, I was touring around the island, and I would see in many communities, neatly stacked kind of, piles of wood and debris. All of that cleanup that happened at the neighborhood and community level was quite impressive. I would also say that the verdict is still out on this. The steps, probably baby steps, but hopefully getting bigger, to embrace renewable energy and to get off the grid. So, I met with a really great group in the interior town of Adjuntas, a group called Casa Pueblo, that's working to distribute solar lanterns and then hopefully to then distribute solar panels to actually have a more resilient power system, precisely because people won't be hooked into the central grid.
Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico caused $90 billion in damages, and we recently learned that over 4,000 people died as a result of the hurricane. And today's guest, Jason Mark, asks in his piece for Sierra, The Case for Climate Reparations, who should pay the costs of the death and destruction caused by human-driven global warming. Jason Mark is the editor of Sierra. It is a magazine of the Sierra Club. We'll put a link to his piece at yourcallradio.org. He is also author of the book Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And this is a pre-taped Your Call. It is our One Planet series, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. Coming up after the break, we will talk about what Jason terms the carbon barons. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Jason Mark, editor of Sierra, the magazine of the Sierra Club. Jason wrote the cover story for the latest issue of the magazine called The Case for Climate Reparations. It's time the carbon barons paid for our unnatural disasters. And he asks, who should pay the costs of the death and destruction caused by human-driven global warming? Let's talk about this term, carbon barons. You write about the fossil fuel industry, and you write that it's the most accurate name we can give these companies is carbon barons.
Well, I mean, that was sort of a little neologism I came up with. Hopefully it'll stick. The academic literature talks about the carbon majors. And, you know, academics doing what they do, you know, often have to sort of use a more bloodless and kind of neutral language. And the carbon majors, I think, more or less work to describe these giant corporate conglomerates, right, that have amassed huge fortunes through the exploration, extraction, refining, marketing, and then sale of fossil fuel energies. But I don't think carbon majors really captures the essence of these massive corporations, the ExxonMobils, the Chevrons, the Royal Dutch Shells. And so I've tried to coin this term, the carbon majors, which I think reveals them a little bit more in their true essence, sort of the feudal logic of their business model, but really their sense of privilege, right? The privilege they kind of, the behavior that they exhibit in the course of them making this audacious claim that they have absolutely no responsibility, again, as they claim, for global climate change. And I think that's an audacious point of view. And I do think it reveals this kind of sense of privilege that they have. And so I think carbon barons is just a more accurate, hopefully more evocative term.
And as you say, the power that they have is just enormous. In the last 20 years, ExxonMobil has routinely broken U.S. records for corporate earnings. In 2014, the company posted its biggest annual profit ever, $32.5 billion.
Yeah. I mean, these, again, are some of the largest companies on the planet. Not necessarily always by market valuation, right? The market acts strangely and thinks that, you know, Facebook, which is essentially just selling advertising, is more valuable than some of these massive globe-spanning companies. But if you look at in terms of total assets, total number of employees, a Royal Dutch Shell or a Chevron dwarf any of our Silicon Valley companies.
And as you report, on January 10th, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio held a press conference to announce that New York City, the largest in the country, was moving to divest its holdings in fossil fuel corporations and was filing a lawsuit against ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Royal Dutch Shell, seeking to recover damages from Hurricane Sandy, as well as the costs for sea level rise adaptation. Since then, we've seen a number of other lawsuits in cities across the country, and they've also been filed by nonprofits. What do you think about these legal challenges and the precedent that they're setting?
Okay, so there's now, as of early June, there are 13 cities and counties that are suing either the biggest oil companies or sometimes biggest oil and gas companies and some coal companies. That includes right here in the Bay Area, cities of San Francisco, Oakland, and Richmond. In total, eight California cities and counties have filed lawsuits. I should also mention Marin County and San Mateo County. Then the suit by New York City, which obviously is important just because of the size of New York. Three municipalities, or I should say counties and cities in Colorado, including Boulder, and King County, Washington, which is where Seattle is based. These are a big deal, and they're being really closely watched by certainly the environmental community and by legal scholars. In a way, they are essentially the environmental version of the landmark cases against Big Tobacco. They're basically making the same case that these companies, okay, the carbon barons, that when their product is even used as intended, creates great harm. And that in addition to that, these companies for many decades misled the public, including the government and ordinary customers, right? All of us filling up our gas tanks, misled us about the risks to using their product, which by the late 1970s, ExxonMobil and the American Petroleum Institute had recognized that the continued burning of fossil fuels could be, in their own words, quote, catastrophic. And yet, even though they knew that their business model was catastrophic, they continued to extract, refine, market, and sell these products. And so that's essentially the case. I mean, it really is. In Mayor de Blasio, when he announced the New York City lawsuit, I mean, he was quite explicit in drawing that connection between big oil and big tobacco. It's going to be up to the courts, and I don't want to get too much down the weeds, but it's a mix here in California of federal and state courts, and then the federal courts in New York and state courts in Colorado and Washington. It's going to be up to the judges to decide whether these claims have gotten merit and whether or not they go through. But they are potentially groundbreaking.
We did a show about this almost a month ago now, and the guest said that because companies like Exxon and Shell have endless amounts of money and some of the best attorneys in the country, they believe that these lawsuits will take years. And their main argument is, well, we're just giving citizens what they want.
Well, that's exactly true. I mean, I was in federal district court here in San Francisco on May 24th when the federal judge here had a hearing on the motion to dismiss by Chevron, Exxon, BP, et cetera. And the Chevron attorney, who, yes, is a very sophisticated, smart guy, got up and said, listen, we recognize that climate change is a problem. Chevron recognizes that climate change is a problem, but the courts are not the venue for dealing with this. And we don't think this is the way to resolve this issue. So what's been interesting in the course of these lawsuits is it has forced the carbon barons to, in a court of law, say that they accept the basic science around human-driven climate change. But then they make a quick pivot and say, and it's not our fault. We can't be held responsible for this. I mean, I honestly think, that's essentially the hollow innocence of the drug dealer, right? Which says, well, we're just giving people what they say they want.
I think it's so important to constantly revisit this. Thanks to exposés by the LA Times and Inside Climate News in 2015, we now know that as early as 1977, scientists at Exxon warned the company that the use of fossil fuels should not be encouraged because of the risk that they posed. In a 1980 presentation to members of the American Petroleum Institute, a scientist warned that a global temperature rise of 2.5 degrees Celsius would likely have major economic consequences, and that further rises would likely produce globally catastrophic effects.
It's the smoking gun in the form of an engineer's memo, really. I mean, those revelations, and thanks so much to those reporters at Inside Climate News and the LA Times and other places, have revealed that long before most people, okay, so yes, scientists and folks at NASA, they knew in the late 1970s that climate change was a threat. Actually, you can go back to the 1960s. I mean, Lyndon Johnson mentions climate change in a 1960s-era State of the Union address. Mm. Okay, so government officials and scientists have certainly known for a long time, but I don't think that in 1977 most Americans were thinking about the greenhouse effect, right? And yet, at that time, the best and brightest within these multinational oil companies, they knew. And that really, again, it is the smoking gun. They knew, and yet they did nothing. And I think that's where we really see a differentiation of responsibility between ordinary folks going about their business and filling up their gas tanks and the carbon barons, right? In the late 1970s and early 1980s, companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell, they had the scientific awareness, they had the political influence, and they had the societal clout to sound an alarm bell. And they didn't, right? Because billions of dollars in profits were on the line. I think it's that failure to act that constitutes a reckless negligence. And that really is the reason why they should be on the hook for covering some of the costs of these superstorms, of this death and destruction related to their business model.
And there's no way to know this, but you have to wonder, what if we had taken action back then? What if we were, you know, almost 100% renewable back today? Where would our coral reefs be right now? Would we still be experiencing this sea level rise? Would we have this temperature rise and all of these horrific fires and floods and hurricanes?
Right, and this gets back to the point we mentioned earlier, which is that half of human emissions have happened since 1988, in the last 30 years, half. Okay, so even if we hadn't avoided all of those, if we had avoided a good chunk of those, you know, it's a significant amount of overall greenhouse gas emissions. We really We are going to pay the cost. We are already paying the cost for the road not taken. And that road was not taken in part because these major fossil fuel companies, again, didn't want to change their business practices because there was so much money on the line.
Today, we are joined by Jason Mark, editor of Sierra, the magazine of the Sierra Club. His cover story is called The Case for Climate Reparations. It's time the carbon barons paid for our unnatural disasters. Jason is author of the book Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. We had him on to talk about that, and you can find his work at yourcallradio.org. This is a pre-taped Your Call, our One Planet series, so unfortunately, we cannot take your phone calls. All right, so we know that Exxon and Shell knew about climate change in the 70s. Not only did they not tell people about it, but as you report and so many people have reported, either individually or through associations like the American Petroleum Institute, these companies gave money to think tanks, researchers, and advertising firms to socially engineer an atmosphere of uncertainty around climate change. Some of the recipients, such as the George C. Marshall Institute, had honed their strategies of deceit years earlier while on the payroll of the tobacco companies, and a 98 memo circulated among American Petroleum Institute members declared that victory will be achieved when average citizens understand the uncertainties in climate science. And that's exactly what happened.
I think that's where the real crime in this case, again, the crime that or the violation that these cities are alleging in their court filings, they refer to all of these findings in the complaints. Right? If you read the lawsuits from the county of San Mateo or county of San Francisco or city of Oakland, they go into great detail about this campaign of deception, and that's certainly a good part of their legal argument here. And this stuff has been well documented by now. I mean, a lot of this, I leaned very heavily on the fantastic Naomi Oreskes book, Merchants of Doubt. She goes into this in great detail. Fantastic book by the Pulitzer Prize winning author and journalist Stephen Call called Private Empire. That's all about the rise of Exxon and ExxonMobil. Goes into this in great detail. And yes, I mean, they again, being ExxonMobil, being the American Petroleum Institute and its member companies, launched a campaign of deception. And the reason why that's so important, right, is because the oil companies, and especially ExxonMobil, who I refer to as the reigning carbon baron, is the largest, publicly traded oil and gas company. ExxonMobil, at the beginning of this year in January, filed something of a countersuit in Texas state courts. It was actually a petition seeking to depose the city and county officials here in the Bay Area and their attorneys, saying that these lawsuits are, quote unquote, a conspiracy against the company, and saying that the company was just exercising its right to free speech in offering a different set of a different interpretation around climate science. Now, we all know, especially in the age of Trump, right, that the political system is awfully forgiving when it comes to, alternative facts and alternate ideas of reality. But here's the thing. The Constitution does not protect fraud is not considered protected speech, right? Mm. And this is what these companies engage in, fraud. I mean, essentially, ExxonMobil saying as late as the year 2000 that there was no link between human activities and the greenhouse effect, that's the First Amendment equivalent of yelling, "There is no fire," in a theater that's rapidly filling with smoke. The Constitution doesn't protect that kind of speech when it tips from just, again, a political point of view to outright fraud and deception.
And this was such a successful campaign because the media, up until, 5 years ago maybe, in the name of, quote, balance, would bring on a scientist with a climate denier who had no backing in science whatsoever and was completely connected to these front groups. I mean, Fox is on its own, but they push this climate denying theme on a regular basis, but so did mainstream outlets.
And at this point, climate science denial has become essentially an article of faith among a certain segment of the population. I mean, I think, round some numbers, I mean, there's basically a third of Americans who I don't think it matters what they hear or learn. They are not going to accept the basic science of climate change. I mean, the really incredible thing is that we still have not broken the fever among some members of Congress and a great swath of the American public about the science of human-driven climate change, even as ExxonMobil and Chevron stand up in a federal court of law and say, we recognize the science. Mm. You've got these holdouts, these dead enders who will not accept it. I don't think we're actually going to reach those people really ever.
Well, you point out that for the carbon barons, everything went according to plan. Between 2006 and 2016, the percentage of Americans who believed that humans were responsible for global warming went down, even as scientists' certainty in their warnings increased.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think those folks who continue to resist the scientific findings, even as ExxonMobil and Chevron admit them in a court of law, I don't think those folks are going to come around.
So if we're dealing with a company like Exxon, they posted $32.5 billion in profits in 2014. How do you take on this industry? Because even in the state of California, you know, you can talk about Trump and all of the climate deniers that he is instilling in government, the people who don't even believe in the EPA, for example. Okay, that's fine. But The Nation magazine, we did a piece about this last year. Michael Mishak, Center for Public Integrity, wrote a great piece called Big Oil's Grip on California. In America's greenest state, the industry has spent $122 million in the past 6 years to shape regulation and legislation, and it wins more than you think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we should remind listeners that California is a major oil-producing state. It's in the top five oil producers in this country. A lot of that is highly localized. Something like 80% of all oil and gas comes from Kern County. Much of the rest of it comes from Los Angeles County. So it's actually just in a small number of places. But this is a petro state. Your question, Rose, how do we break that kind of grip, the carbon barons' grip on our political system? Some of it is going to happen through lawsuits like this. I mean, I want to make clear, I don't think tort law is going to save the planet. I mean, fundamentally, this is a political question. But eventually, one of these suits will, I think, get green-lighted through some court that will spur other cities and municipalities and hopefully at some point a state to probably join and file their own suits. And again, the model of the tobacco lawsuits could be instructive here. I mean, those states' attorneys general who initially filed those lawsuits, they were voices in the wilderness for a long time. And it wasn't until you started to see dozens of states joining the suits against big tobacco that you had a credible legal threat. So some of it's legal. Some of it, of course, is grassroots citizen activism, right? The efforts to stop things like the Keystone XL pipeline or the Dakota Access pipeline are hugely important for people to just say, no more. We cannot continue to make investments in dead-end infrastructure. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, though, it does come back to politics. I mean, essentially, we need to elect climate champions at all levels of government. That means, you know, in the California State House and in the Oregon and the Washington State House. It means then getting climate champions into the U.S. Congress. I mean, fundamentally, climate change and dealing with climate change is it's a political problem, and it's going to require a political solution, which means changing the laws. You can't change the laws unless you've got your champions in places of power.
And as we're seeing these horrific floods and fires, droughts in California, so many things happening across the country, where do you think this is going in terms of tackling this climate reparations question?
Well, again, I think some of it's going to stay in the courts. I mean, I think we'll continue to see more cases like that. I continue to report on this, and I do think other cities are going to file lawsuits perhaps this summer. I mean, these are going to continue to build. So that is the one way to apportion some responsibility, to apportion some accountability. Again, I think the other way is going to be electing climate champions. I mean, it's worth pointing out that perhaps eventually, if more and more of these cases build up, it may go to the U.S. Congress. I mean, you may actually see the carbon barons go to Congress and ask for relief and immunity from future lawsuits, in which case you really would have a debate over, okay, if we're going to give the carbon barons legal immunity, what does the public at large get? Well, in that case, and this is, again, just sort of spitballing among legal scholars, but perhaps what the public at large gets is these companies putting hundreds of billions of dollars into a public abatement fund, similar to the tobacco fund, and I think possibly or ideally also an economy-wide price on carbon.
When you were talking, I was just thinking about when the presidents and CEOs of the largest tobacco companies testified before Congress. This happened in 1994. And this was just such a, I'm just looking this up right now. They testified for 6 hours with sharp questioning by members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee on health and the environment. They refused to budge under stringent questioning that they knew cigarettes were addictive. Each stated under oath that they did not believe nicotine was addictive. I'm reading from Tobacco Free Florida. Within months, a perjury investigation was initiated by the Department of Justice. Ultimately, the DOJ claimed it did have enough evidence to prosecute for perjury because the CEOs testified under oath they believed that nicotine did not addict people. Because they used the word believe, they could not be prosecuted for perjury. Do you think we'd ever see Chevron and CEO being called up to Capitol Hill to testify?
I do think, yeah. I mean, I think obviously not with this current Congress, but if you were to see a change in the leadership in the House of Representatives, yes, I do think we could see something similar. Is the major oil and gas companies being called before Congress to talk about what they knew and when they knew it and what their response was. But, you know, this brings us back to the importance of these lawsuits, which is that when you go into a court of law, the rules, right, about speech change, right? Alternative facts in a court of law are called perjury. Mm-hmm. And the importance of these lawsuits is what may be found in the course of discovery, right? As lawyers get to depose the other side, as they get to request documents, et cetera. So, I mean, you already have two, it's important, we didn't mention this yet, but two states' attorneys general in New York and Massachusetts have got investigations very similar to these local lawsuits. I'm not going to get into the details of the law. Some of them are unique to what can go on under New York state law because the stock exchange is based there, and they have to actually have more about investor rights than necessarily citizen rights. But those state attorneys in general investigations are likely to find out some important things in the course of discovery. And if and when one of these local or county lawsuits move forward in the course of discovery, they are very likely will find out, will make other revelations, fresh revelations, again, about what the carbon barons knew, when they knew it, and what their response was as the threat of global climate change, of human-driven global climate change, was becoming clear.
You end your piece, The Case for Climate Reparations, by writing, "The urgency of this attempt cannot be overstated. This effort to apportion responsibility is in a race against time. The longer the carbon barons are able to delay justice, the sooner a worse judgment will come for all of us, the innocent as well as the guilty."
I think it's true. I mean, this is a potentially landmark effort, and it's important. This is not, I want to make clear, this is not retribution. This is not plaintiff's attorneys trying to get a big payday. This is really trying to apportion responsibility for a crime as vast as the profit-driven alteration of the Earth's atmosphere. I'm not saying in this piece, and I make very clear, that the carbon barons aren't the only one who are responsible. I mean, there's some blame, Rose, on you, and there's some blame on me. I mean, we have known as well, and our lifestyles also contribute to climate change. So I'm not saying that the carbon barons alone are responsible for the death and destruction related to global warming. But certainly they have some of the responsibility. I just do not think it passes the BS test when the Chevron attorney gets up there in federal court of law and says, we have no responsibility here. Mm. I mean, they've got some smidgen of responsibility. It will be up to a federal judge. It will eventually, perhaps, be up to a jury to decide what share of the responsibility pie they hold. But I do not think it passes a basic credibility test for an ExxonMobil or a Chevron to say, we have no responsibility for the damage and destruction from global climate change.
Especially when they knew.
Especially
and
when they knew.
And their own scientists said, this is going to happen.
It's an axiom of U.S. politics that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. And in this case, the cover-up is the campaign of deception that was waged throughout the 90s, the early aughts, the mid-aughts. Again, you had ExxonMobil as late as the year 2000 running ads on the opinion page of the New York Times, calling into question scientists' certainty linking human activities and climate change. I mean, at that point, you already had a global treaty around climate change. Scientists were we're very certain at that point about these linkages. And so in some ways, it's really the cover-up as much as it is the original violation that I think is going to get these companies in real trouble.
Final thoughts. Is there anything else in your research that you discovered, uncovered, that we haven't touched on?
I do think it was the depth and the sophistication of those campaigns in the 90s and the early 2000s that it's just incredible to read about. And a lot of it's been in the public domain for a while. Again, I lean very heavily on the work of Steve Call, on Naomi Oreskes, but folks should go and read those books themselves because it's going to keep you up at night just to realize the intentionality, right? The sort of self-awareness that went into those deception campaigns.
Yeah, we actually had both of them on over the years. You can find those stories at your call, or those shows at yourcallradio.org. I mean, what's amazing about this is we have all of the information now. You cannot say this is a debate. You cannot say, well, maybe they didn't know. It's there. We have it.
Right.
Jason Mark is editor of Sierra, the magazine of the Sierra Club, and his cover story is called The Case for Climate Reparations. It's time the carbon barons paid for our unnatural disasters. In the story, Jason asks a very important question, and we will do many, many shows on this question. Who should pay the costs of the death and destruction caused by human-driven global warming? Jason Mark is author of Satellites in the High Country, Searching for the Wild in the Age of Man. And you can find his cover story and more about his writing at yourcallradio.org. Also, check out Sierra. I just recently subscribed to this magazine, and it's full of really interesting stories. Jason, thank you for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Laura Wenis for line producing and Josh Wilner for doing our social media. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.